the fact that the migraine feels so unpredictable, right? So, and it will often come out at a time when there's something going on, right? So it could be a happy stress, right? It can be a birthday party, and then suddenly your child has a migraine, and that's really frustrating. And so just, you know, trying to not overreact to that and kind of go with the flow, as you have to in life anyway, right? So trying to do your best to just take everything in stride as best as you can and, you know, acknowledge that was really frustrating.
Migraine affects 1 in 10 children, impacting not just their physical health, but their education, their friendships, and their emotional well-being. For kids and their parents, navigating diagnosis, treatment, and support can be overwhelming. Today, we are joined by Dr. Christina Spurka, director of the Pediatric Headache Program at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. She's a leading clinician and researcher dedicated to improving care for young people with headache disorders. Dr. Spurka will share the latest on effective treatments, lifestyle strategies, and how to support kids and teens living with migraine. Dr. Spurka, welcome to the Migraine World Summit.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you.
Well, I'd love to dive into a comprehensive review of pediatric migraine, including acute treatment, prevention, and support. But to start, to really talk about really the landscape of pediatric migraine, we know that migraine can be quite different from person to person, and perhaps even more so in children and adolescents versus adults. How might it present differently in youth versus adulthood?
As you said, you know, migraine affects about 1 in 10 children. That ranges from children who have low frequency headaches and essentially have a headache once a month or maybe even less, to children who have very, very frequent headache. And so about 1 or 2 out of every 10 children walking around high school, teens walking around high school, have chronic migraine, and many of those have headache that's actually continuous. And so we see really a full spectrum of migraine frequency in children, unfortunately. And we also see some variability in terms of how that might express itself. So particularly in younger children, migraine may look a little different. Sometimes the GI symptoms are more prominent. Oftentimes the pain will come up very, very quickly, and then they'll vomit, and maybe then they'll feel better. So sometimes that may evolve. Also, children may, present rather with things like cyclic vomiting, episodic torticollis. So different essentially manifestations can come out. Dr. Gelfand's work even essentially looking at things like colic. And so, you know, are those early presentations of something that's going to ultimately develop into migraine? So there's those early life manifestations. And then essentially as children are in school age, they sometimes, you know, will have what otherwise appear to be relatively typical migraine attacks, but they are often briefer. Sometimes, for example, the pain may be bilateral as opposed to typically being on one side in adults. And so they look a little different, but more typical of migraine. And then as the children get older, essentially it becomes more and more typical of an adult pattern. Another thing we've actually then looked at, we have a large database at CHOP of children who have seen us for a new patient visit for migraine, or for headache in general. And we also see that as they get into adolescence, we see more and more things that are not your typical standard diagnostic features, but things like dizziness that we hear so often from patients, right? Brain fog, trouble thinking, all of those things essentially become much more common as they present essentially into the teenage years.
Interesting. So in very young children, migraine may not look at all like we're used to thinking of migraine in adults, perhaps GI symptom focused, et cetera. As they age, it might get a little bit more typical looking, but with some different features, bilateral versus one-sidedness of pain, and then evolution of some of those other symptoms like dizziness and vertigo.
Exactly. Yeah.
How underdiagnosed is migraine in children and adolescents? And what are some of the biggest challenges in getting an accurate and timely diagnosis?
The statistic is, if you think about children with chronic migraine, it's, you know, essentially probably less than half have seen a clinician within the preceding year. So that's kids with chronic migraine, right? Then we think about episodic migraine. People don't even necessarily know that it's migraine. I mean, I have many, many times had someone sit in front of me and say, "That's migraine. I didn't think kids could have migraine," right? So they have to come to attention in order to get a diagnosis. And then, of course, the clinician has to be comfortable making a diagnosis.
What should parents look for, and what information should they gather in exploring this at the beginning?
Absolutely. So I think when we are evaluating a child who is presenting with headache, and I'm assuming this is headache, right? I'm essentially, as we talked about earlier, for younger children, they may actually present with belly pain. They may present with recurrent episodes of vomiting without other signs of infection, right? So take what I'm saying about headache and apply it most too, right? But so the pattern to me is really the most crucial part, because if there's a child who has an attack and then it resolves, and then some time passes and then they have an attack and it resolves, I am much less worried about other causes. I think that that is much, much more likely to be consistent with migraine. Of course, not everybody reads the textbook, right? And so things aren't necessarily always that clean. And we absolutely see kids who will present with a headache that doesn't go away or maybe triggered by things. We see lots of kids who have a migrainous headache after concussion. But that pattern piece is very important. And then understanding, how does it present, right? So what are the symptoms? What's the pattern of the symptoms in terms of what comes first and second and third? You know, is it just pain in isolation? Are there other symptoms that are occurring as well? Sometimes the caregivers can be the best one to really observe, right? So the child may not report the light's bothering me, but they suddenly want the lights turned down. They yell at their siblings for being noisy, right? To be honest, as we're describing this, I don't always recommend that families keep diaries once they're sort of at the point of diagnosis and things like that, because we don't always want to draw too much attention to it. But in the very beginning, when we're trying to understand what's going on and trying to get to a point of diagnosis, it is very helpful.
Great point. Thank you. So after a diagnosis, the immediate goal is often identifying ways to effectively, acutely treat attacks when they occur. Why is early and effective treatment for each migraine attack important?
There are hints that we see that essentially if we are appropriately treating the acute attacks, that it actually may change the trajectory over time. And so when we are making that diagnosis and giving our initial counseling, we are recommending a number of different pieces. But when we speak about the treatment of the acute attack, I think so often families are concerned about giving children medication. And so they feel like, well, I should wait till it's really bad, or I should wait until, like, you know, they can't stand it anymore. And our recommendation is instead, please actually treat it early, right? As soon as the pain is spiking up, we want you to use the acute treatments. And I'm saying medication, but actually there's non-medication options as well, which we'll talk about. But get into that right immediately, because then it helps to resolve that attack more quickly. And that actually sometimes then will shorten the attack, right? So as opposed to an attack maybe lasting 2 days because it was treated very late, if it's treated early, perhaps it'll go away in an hour or two. And then essentially, right, then that's less time that the child is disabled by the migraine.
Can you walk us through the first line treatments that you recommend to treat a migraine attack in a child or teen as it's happening?
This is an area where I would tell you that our official guidelines and our real practice don't always align. So the official guideline recommendations are to use either ibuprofen or acetaminophen as a first line, essentially. Depends on which guideline you read, but generally speaking, essentially ibuprofen has, you know, overall the best level of evidence. And for many children, that's effective, but it isn't for all. We will also think about all the other non-medicine things we can do, right? Essentially things about, you know, thinking about how can we consider what might be bringing on that attack? And are there things we can think about, you know, to try to manage that, right? So is it that they need access to a water bottle because they're really dehydrated by the, you know, 11 a.m. in the school day, and they need to get access to water so that they're not dehydrated by that point, right?
Now, how do you decide when to take that step beyond ibuprofen and acetaminophen? Is there a certain number of attacks that haven't been well handled by an NSAID that would lead you to take that next step to a triptan?
If there is an individual attack that's insufficiently treated, or if there have been a number of attacks that are just seeming to last longer than they really need to, then I will absolutely escalate to a triptan.
And what can you tell caregivers who may be experiencing their first foray into a prescription with their child about what concerns they may have about safety when it comes to using something like a triptan when that is warranted to help support their child?
We've been using triptans now for 25 plus years, right? And so I do feel very comfortable using, for example, rizatriptan because of the fact that it's been, you know, FDA labeled for so many years for such a young age. And so we've got cumulatively a lot of evidence to say it's safe. Nothing is without side effects, right? I mean, everything has potential for side effects. And so there absolutely are children who are going to have side effects to it. Being transparent about those, the potential for side effects, but then also reassuring of, you know, there are other options. If this doesn't work for you, right, there's other things we can try. And for the vast majority of patients, we are able to find something that does work for them that doesn't cause unbearable side effects.
So let's now move on to talk about prevention, because once families have an acute plan in place, the next question is often, okay, how can we prevent as many attacks from happening as possible? So let's start, if we can, with non-pharmacologic options. What approaches exist, and when do you consider them for children and adolescents?
So we think about non-pharmacologic options for prevention, honestly, all the time. So even in children who have relatively low frequency of attacks, we are always trying to think about, are there things that we can do to essentially balance reducing the risk of migraine, but also balancing real life? And so I think it's really important to think about, for example, you know, the migraine brain likes consistency. To think about, you know, consistency of sleep, thinking about what the water you're drinking and the exercise you're getting in everybody. When the CHAMP study came out a decade ago, and we found that essentially 2/3 of children got better in every group, we thought about, well, what else are we doing, right? So taking good care of yourself and taking acute medications early, as we just discussed, is probably a large part of how to really prevent migraine attacks. So that's sort of where we start. And then the other thing I would think of in terms of other holistic things is sometimes our first line of preventive pill-based therapies is actually vitamins.
You don't have to take it in all at once. You can return to extended interviews at your own pace with the All Access Pass.
In what circumstances, when you're thinking about prevention, would pharmacologic options come into play?
So I think that answer will depend on who you ask right now. I would say that most of us, I think, at this point, first reach for supplements before we reach for prescription medications. However, there's a little bit of difference in terms of, obviously, the family's perspective, right? So there are some families who really feel struggling that they want to go to a prescription medication first, and that's an option. And then there are those of us who also might make a different decision depending on, for example, the headache frequency. I would tell you that my bias was that if I met a child who had a continuous headache, I was thinking I probably needed to go to prescription medications first rather than go with a supplement, because I felt like maybe I don't need just that, you know, pill-taking behavior and those things, but maybe I really need what's in that med to actually make a difference. Interestingly, we are in the process actually we've just recently been showing at conferences and writing up a study of new daily persistent headache. So that time when essentially a headache starts and is continuous then. And by and large, unfortunately, those headaches are a little bit more difficult to treat. They don't respond as well to typical therapies. And my bias, as I said, right, was that I needed to use prescription medications. But when we looked back and did a chart review, we had 172 kids who had with NDPH. The rate of response to prescriptions and to oral prescriptions and supplements was actually very similar. And so, to be honest, it wasn't great. It was about a third in that circumstance. So not nearly as good as our responses in migraine, but still, it wasn't necessarily different. So it really made me rethink my practice in terms of, you know, hey, maybe it's reasonable to say, let's start with a vitamin.
One of our community members named Nat asked, for adolescent girls experiencing menstrual migraine, what are the pros and cons of using birth control as part of prevention at a young age?
There are pros and cons of using birth control overall, right? And so I would say that my approach to thinking about menstrual migraine is to first think about, could we do perimenstrual prophylaxis, right? So if an adolescent girl has regular periods and they know when their period is coming, could we use something like a long-acting NSAID, a long-acting triptan? Sometimes I've even used vitamin E for a few days before and then the duration of menses. And oftentimes what we'll do is we'll use, if the child really does have significant migraine around their period, we'll use a low-dose continuous medication for several months in a row to actually avoid and decrease the frequency of the period. The other piece that comes into play with this is whether there's a concern about migraine with aura. And so essentially in the setting of migraine with aura, we think about the fact that there may be a slight increased risk of stroke. And then if we're adding an estrogen-containing birth control pill, then essentially that also potentially could be additive and increased risk of stroke. This is obviously, thankfully, not something we really see very often in teenagers, right? This is a relatively theoretical risk for our patients, but it is a theoretical risk on a population level. And so in that circumstance, we will also think about, is it appropriate to start with a progesterone-containing medication, progesterone-containing pill first? Right, either something like a mini pill or things like Depo, Nexplanon. And actually, I've had many teenagers nowadays get IUDs because then it's essentially locally delivered hormone that's not systemically delivered and doesn't have care at the same risks. So I would say that all of the things you might think about in a 20-year-old, we absolutely do think about in a teenage girl as well.
You mentioned earlier the possibility of the use of GPANs, a CGRP-targeted therapy, in the context of acute treatment, treating an attack when it happens. And we're starting to see CGRP-targeted medications move into pediatric care. One, from an Ezimab or Ajovy, is now FDA-approved for children 6 to 17 who weigh at least 45 kilograms. What does that mean for real-world care in prevention and use of these CGRP monoclonal antibodies?
So Feminazmab looks great in the short term. It's been around for 7 years. And so we have 7 years of long-term data, right? I don't have 40 years of long-term data like I do with some of the other medications I'm using. And so it's the devil you know, the devil you don't know, right? I said feminazumab looks great and has fewer side effects. And some families, particularly families where one of the parents has used either that or another medication in that class, they are often very eager to move forward with that. Plus, of course, it has the advantages of things like monthly injection as opposed to a daily pill and all of those. However, many kids don't want a shot either. And so there are definitely are circumstances where they're not interested in taking an injection and they'd rather stick with something that's oral in the beginning. The major other piece of this is insurance. And so even though it was FDA approved in August, we absolutely are still getting denials. And it is unclear if we're going to be able to go to feminazumab early or if we're going to have to fail first a few other therapies. Obviously, there have been different position statements and things coming out saying you shouldn't have to fail first. But the reality is that's what insurance has been enforcing. Many of the insurance companies will change their policies as of the turn of the year. And so I think it's going to be really interesting to see what happens in the beginning of 2026. And then, of course, there are many, many other trials that are ongoing and, some of them are wrapping up. And so we're very hopeful that perhaps there will be more information coming out. The feminazumab episodic migraine trial was positive. The feminazumab chronic migraine trial was not, unfortunately, better. Essentially, the feminazumab was not superior to placebo. So again, if I have a patient who has not had success with a number of other therapies who has chronic migraine, at this point, I'm still offering them feminazumab because I've seen it work, right? And so this is an example of the official and then the real world. But again, I think we're all very hopeful to see what happens with the trials that are coming out too.
That's great. Well, this came up briefly a little bit earlier, Dr. Spirka. What about these non-medicinal neuromodulation devices for acute treatment and or prevention of migraine in children and adolescents? And neuromodulation may be a very new concept to some people.
Neuromodulation has been part of our treatment armamentarium for actually probably close to a decade now. But we have so much more access now than we did in the past. And so there are a number of devices. The majority of them have a little bit of evidence. The REN device, the Neurovio device, has actually quite a lot of evidence in children and adolescents. And both due to the lower upfront cost, as well as the added additional evidence we have from pediatrics, that is often our first go-to neuromodulation device. We have demos of most of the devices in our clinics, and so I find it very helpful to be able to show a child what the device looks like. And so, thanks to our nurses, we've got a number of different things. We'll do a little show and tell in clinic.
And for those viewers who are interested in learning more about neuromodulation, we do have a specific interview on it this year. What it is, how it works, different options, including the ages to which they are FDA cleared for this year.
Yeah, excellent.
Moving on, Dr. Spurka, now to talk a little bit more about whole care, as we've touched on here while talking about acute and preventive options. There is a strong link between migraine and mental health, particularly anxiety and depression, not surprisingly. How do you address this in your clinical practice? What advice do you have for parents who are really interested in supporting, you know, their child's emotional well-being while managing migraine?
It's something that we just discuss very openly. So we have two psychologists actually on our team. And for we do essentially multidisciplinary intakes with our psychologist, as well as actually our physical therapist, for children who have not had benefit from a couple of medications, right? So second opinions, transferring within our division, et cetera. And so our psychologist is part of those visits. But even in every other of our intakes, essentially, we are asking about mental health. We're asking about stressors. We're asking about anxiety because it is such a crucial part. And we do our best to really just normalize it. When we're thinking about how essentially anxiety and depression may be related to headache, I think it's also important to acknowledge sort of cause and effect, right? So there absolutely are circumstances where, for example, if a child's worried about their math test, that may bring on a migraine. But there's also at the same time a large component of anxiety around the migraine attack and how that's going to affect life. And so I have numerous times talked to colleagues who will say, oh, you know, the child's really depressed and that's why I've got a chronic headache. Well, pause. Were they depressed before they had a chronic headache, or are they feeling really depressed because they're not going to school and they're miserable and they're, you know, everything in their life has changed? And so I think it is really important that we think about anxiety and depression and that we treat anxiety and depression and we acknowledge it for what it is. But I also think it's important that we acknowledge the role that the migraine itself has in contributing to it, right? Both in the acute attack, because certainly the acute attack can affect your mood, but also in the overall realm of life.
So for caregivers whose children are not being seen and treated in a headache clinic, for instance, when should they consider seeking additional support from a psychologist or a therapist as really part of the migraine management plan that may focus on factors separate from and outside of that where they're seen?
So there's good evidence that cognitive behavioral therapy is very effective in migraine treatment. And again, that's not to treat the anxiety. That's a separate thing. It's great for anxiety as well, but to treat the migraine, even in children who don't have a diagnosis of anxiety or depression. And we absolutely, again, will offer that to many of our patients. There's an ongoing study looking at this essentially now in terms of if we're actually, the study is, it's being ran out of Cincinnati Children's. We're looking at cognitive behavioral therapy plus or minus use of amitriptyline. So do you even need a pill-based therapy? Perhaps CBT alone is sufficient. So I think that's an excellent option, and it's a very good non-medication option. If a family comes in and says, I don't want a med, we will talk about essentially the fact that there's really good evidence for CBT. Is that something that they're willing to consider?
So migraine can take a toll, not just on the child, but really on a whole family, certainly caregivers. How can parents and caregivers care for their own mental health while they are supporting a child with migraine or any chronic illness, really?
There's two pieces to this, I think. So one is the fact that the migraine feels so unpredictable, right? So, and it will often come out at a time when there's something going on, right? So it could be a happy stress, right? It can be a birthday party, and then suddenly your child has a migraine, and that's really frustrating. And so just, you know, trying to not overreact to that and kind of go with the flow, as you have to in life anyway, right? So trying to do your best to just take everything in stride as best as you can and, you know, acknowledge that was really frustrating, right? Don't pretend it wasn't frustrating. It was, but, you know, also try to keep going. But then I think the other piece of it is also just to make sure that the relationships in the family are not taken over by migraine, right? So you don't want to put all of your attention on your child who's in the middle of a migraine attack and not take care of the other kids. But it's also okay to expect your child with migraine to do some chores, right? It's okay to expect them to fold the laundry. It's okay to ask them to empty the dishwasher. And I'm sorry you have a migraine, but we need to keep going, right? The same way that I think it's appropriate to expect them to go to school even when they're not feeling perfectly, because it's the better thing for them in the long run.
You mentioned school. So let's pivot and touch briefly, if we can, on education. School can bring some extra challenges for a child living with migraine. And one of our Migraine World Summit viewers, Anna, said she'd love help in better working with her son's school. Like many, she may not know about an organization called Migraine at School that actually works specifically on this advocacy with schools to support families with their children's educations. What do you see in your experience as the most crucial approaches or accommodations to help a student with migraine succeed academically?
So I'm glad you brought that organization up. They're excellent. So I think that it's important to really partner with your school. And in some ways, the most crucial thing for a child with a low frequency of attacks is to make sure they can go to the nurse and get their meds, right? And so understanding that the child's not faking, the child's not making it up, right? Just because the migraine comes on in the middle of the math test doesn't mean they're faking and they're trying to get out of the math test, right? It's just sometimes stress brings on a migraine. That's not faking. Right? So we're very clear of that with such a when we have our 504 letters. But I think then also flexibility is key, right? So if the child is developing a migraine attack and they're supposed to do X, Y, Z, right? Maybe they're supposed to take a test next period and they're really not going to do well on that test if they have brain fog in the middle of their attack. But perhaps by the time they take their meds, they're better at the end of the school day. They can take the migraine, they can take the test at the end of the school day or a different day, right? And so just flexibility. Say they make it through school, and right? Maybe they've had a migraine all week. Maybe it's an adolescent girl with her period. And they make it through the school day, then can we get permission not to do the homework in that afternoon, right? So can we essentially just get a little bit of slack here? So the child's pushing themselves really hard. Can we ask for just flexibility so that they can keep going, right? They're not losing ground and losing, essentially getting behind their peers. But they also maybe don't have to do absolutely everything all the time. And sometimes that's asking school. And honestly, sometimes it's giving the child permission because sometimes it's actually really the child who's driven to do everything and not ask for accommodations. And so trying to balance all of that.
Interesting. And you mentioned the 504 plan, which in the U.S. allows for accommodation in schools for kids with certain conditions. And those may be called different things and available in different ways in different countries. What is the best way for a caregiver to approach a school about pursuing some kind of accommodation through a plan like that or other?
Within the U.S., essentially, typically the public schools are using a formal 504 plan. Children who are in private school, it's often not a formal 504 plan, but it's usually a very similar process. And so essentially, it's just a matter of requesting to the school to say, my child has a medical condition, and migraine is now officially in the list of things that are acknowledged there, which is awesome. Thank you, advocates. That my child has a need to have a little bit of variation, right? To have a little bit of support, extra support and accommodation. And so whether that's the child's teacher, whether that's the guidance counselor, the school nurse, essentially just approaching them and saying, I need a little extra flexibility. I need my child to be guaranteed certain things because it will help them. It will level the playing field and help them to be able to perform the same as their peers is really important.
And I think it's so important for caregivers to understand that options like this exist. They're appropriate. And there's an organization like Migraine at School that can actually help them work through this to support their children in education. One thing to touch on here as we wrap up, Dr. Spurka, is really about the idea of empowering people of this age, right? Adolescence is such a key time for so many things, including identity and independence. How can both clinicians and parents help teens manage migraine without feeling like they're defined by it or limited by it, while also encouraging them to take ownership of it for their best health?
We actively try to coach teens to take more and more ownership of managing their migraine, right? I will often say to my patients, if you act like an adult, your parents will treat you like an adult, right? And so if you are able to think, to take your medications consistently, then they will let you take your medication, right? If you are forgetting it 4 out of 5 days, then they're going to nudge you and bug you and you're not going to be bugged, right? And so can you think about maybe, tools on your cell phone and things like that to remind you, I am both myself and certainly our, I would say it's standard in pediatrics that I talk to the child, right? I don't talk to the parent. Yes, the parent is part of the conversation, but I start with the child, right? And I want you to tell me what's going on, right? I got 5 messages from your mom in the past 6 months, but I want to hear from you what's been going on. And really invite them to tell their story. And the parents are there for backup, but that's training them for when they're an adult and they're essentially going to need to do this independently. So I think, as it both in our office visits, but also at home, the more that they can essentially advocate for themselves and do for themselves, that essentially that brings on that responsibility and that maturity.
So looking to the future, Dr. Spirka, what gives you the most hope for the next generation of kids growing up with migraine, both in terms of treatment or an understanding?
To me, I think it's huge that we're acknowledging it, right? Like, it's so many parents will say, oh, I had this, but nobody paid attention or nobody diagnosed it, right? And now they're bringing their child in for care and that child is able to receive care. And it seems that, you know, if we are able to help that child early enough in the course, that we're going to change the trajectory and that we're going to actually help them, that perhaps maybe these teens in our office are not going to grow into, you know, having terrible migraine as adults. I'm not going to promise they're not going to have some, but, you know, many of them may get to the point where it's really a minimal problem for them.
This topic is so important, right? Talking about this, understanding and being able to feel better equipped to help support children, adolescents, teens living with migraines. We're so appreciative of you being here with us, Dr. Spirka, to walk us through all of the important aspects related to it. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I'm grateful for the opportunity. Thank you very much.
And where can people who are interested in learning more about you or your work go?
We have a website for the CHOP Headache Program. And so we have a number of resources there. I would say there's, you know, it's you mentioned migrated schools. There's a lot of resources available to learn more about headache. Headache Relief Guide is another website I would mention. I said that's not me specifically, but again, about information about migraine in children.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. Dr. Spirka, thank you for joining us on the Migraine World Summit.
Thank you.